Okay.
Om Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. Om Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. Om Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai. Om Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai. Om Shri Ram, Jai Jai Ram, Jai Jai. Om Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. Om Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. Om Shri Ram, Jai Ram. Very good, very good. Just to continue the idea of starting with a little bit of humor. This is something actually that Shivadam sent out to our little listserv a year ago. Take it off. My shirt's not torn, so. It's called Life After Delivery? Question mark. In a mother's womb, there were two babies. One asked the other, "Do you believe in life after delivery?" The other replies, "Why, of course, there has to be something after delivery. Maybe we're here to prepare ourselves for what will be later." "Nonsense," says the other. "There's no life after delivery. What would that life be?" "I don't know. But there'll be more light than here, I think. Maybe we'll walk with our legs and eat with our mouths." The other said, "That's absurd. Walking is impossible. And eating with our mouths? That's ridiculous. The umbilical cord supplies nutrition. Life after delivery is to be excluded." "The umbilical cord is too short. I think there's something, and maybe it's different than here." The other, "No one has come back from here." Delivery is the end of life. And in the after delivery, it is nothing but darkness and anxiety. And it takes us nowhere. "Oh, I don't know. But certainly, we'll see Mother, and she'll take care of us." "Mother? You believe in Mother? Where is she now?" "Whoa, I think she's all around us. It's in her that we live. Without her, there would not be this world. I don't see her, so it's not logical that she exists." To which the other replied, "Sometimes, when you're in the silence, you can hear her. You can perceive her. I believe there's a reality after delivery, and we're here to prepare ourselves for that reality." Shivadam's got it. He can get in. I'll send it to Barakat. She can send it to you all. Is that all right? I can do it from here. I could actually do it now here. No, I can. And this is a very important lesson. My music guru taught me this. It was an Indian expression. He said, "One time work doing is the best." One time work doing is the best. Something's on your mind, do it. Clear your mind. I think I'm... What's that?
I just wondered if you could send around that.
I sent it to somebody, but I can send that to... It's on my website. Okay. It's an easy download. And in fact, Shivadam's the new content manager for my website, so... He should have access to it. No. I wasn't trying to embarrass him. He hasn't started yet, but he will be. You know, he's agreed to it. And by the way, Azim is back home. So you know, here we go. Yeah.
You can love, serve, and you don't have to.
exactly. I've always felt the word remember is a tricky word, because in one's, I mean, we all understand it's pointing to something, but it discounts evolution. It discounts that we're here for some purpose. Because if we already knew, then why are we in this whole rigmarole? You know? Yeah, that just seems to... you know, it's ever becoming Buddha, and there's something going on. There's not nothing going on. Eternity stays eternity. So we came from something, and we're going to something. And here's a very beautiful way that Hazrat Anayat Khan talks about it. There's a little, I didn't know I was going to tell you about this, but this is just, it's in volume 9 of the Sufi message, and he's teaching on parables. And so he's teaching on the story of Lot from the Bible, the story of Lot. I don't know how many of you have read that, but it's extraordinary. So the storyline, as we know, is or we might not know, all of you biblical scholars, and I'm not one, but basic storyline is Lot, who is a descendant of Abraham. He's married. He has two daughters and two sons-in-law. Okay? He has a vision from God. Things are screwed up. Take your family and get out of town. He tells them his vision. The two sons-in-laws don't go along. The two daughters and the mother, you know, his wife go along. But halfway through, they're told not to go back. And she turns and turns to a pillar of salt. So she doesn't get to go on the whole journey. She's gone on half the journey. And then he arrives to these caves of light, you know, of, you know, heaven realm with his daughters. So that's the basic story. Okay. So, Anayat Khan goes now to the yoga teachings about the five bodies, the five body constitution of being, of a human being. The Ana Maya Kosh, the Prana Maya Kosh, Ana Maya Kosh, Prana Maya Kosh, Man Maya Kosh, Vijnana Maya Kosh, and Ananda Maya Kosh. So I'll translate for you. The first one is the physical body, the Ana Maya Kosh, Maya, the body of the relative. The relative body, the relative physical body. Then comes the Prana Maya Kosh, the breathing body, then man, which is the root of our word human, translated as mind, the relative mind body, and then comes vijnana, which means wisdom body, you know, like gyan, the root gyan, or it's where we get our word knowledge, you know. And then Anandamaya Kosh, the bliss body, body of bliss. Clear? Physical body, the breathing body, the body of mind, the wisdom body, and the bliss body, body of bliss. Okay, so he says, the message from, you know, Lot represents the human soul disciple, you know, inheritor from Abraham, representing the message of God, gets the message, don't put your faith in physical existence. You won't find what you're looking for. You have to leave that behind. And so that's the metaphor of leaving town. He invites his whole family. Now, the two sons-in-law are the physical body and the breathing body. Because they're not a part of the soul. They're just something, it's like a shirt. They don't get to go on the journey, so they stay behind. Now, in the parable, the way he describes it, the mother represents the mind. And so he says, what's necessary for wisdom and bliss to take birth is the marriage of the soul and the mind. The marriage of the soul and the mind. Without the union between Lot and his wife, the daughters can't take birth, the body of bliss and the body of wisdom. But the mind, whose nature is doubt, doesn't get to go on the whole journey. Awakening is beyond mind, and the soul arrives at wisdom and bliss. That's all in that story. Holy cow. Isn't that amazing? So look at that, you know, what I was saying that about remember, something's arising, a marriage between mind and soul, which allows for wisdom and bliss to take birth. So that's where I feel the word remember is weak. Because that suggests the whole picture was already formed before, that nothing's going on. But there is a part where nothing's going on, but there's a part where something's going on too. So that's just a personal view. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yes, Barkat?
Well, just something, a term that, well, we all used recently, really got me. Which was, we are adding to the evolution of the God ideal on earth. So that is, you know, our concept of what that bliss and wisdom are. We are, by our opening up ever more into the fuller truth of it, that's what we're giving birth to. So it's remembering, we're lifting the veils, the 70,000 veils, and the concept that we're able to grasp or to release into is evolving.
Yeah. Here's another way to look at it. Like, why bother with this whole thing if we already knew? There was nothing to do. What? You follow me? It's like, why would we bother, you know, taking incarnation and suffering so much if there wasn't something that was evolutionarily accomplished? United with all the illuminated souls. The illuminated souls became illuminated from being unilluminated. You know, some awakening. So marriage of soul and mind to give birth to wisdom and bliss while having in the family body and breath, you know, physical breath. That was there in order, you know, but it isn't part of the destination. Doesn't get to go on the journey. Okay, just an aside. Since Barkat mentioned this, I think it's an important part of our lineage teaching, and I don't know if all of you have really looked into it carefully, especially in the way Hazrat Inayat Khan gives the journey. And so he calls it the four stages of the path to God. The four stages of the path to God. And I'll try to describe them in my own way. The first stage, I want to read you his opening paragraph about it because it's just hilarious. You'll love it. Then I'll just teach it to you. Here we go. The ones who stand outside of Sufism are always confused as the Sufi's attitude towards God. They cannot make out whether the Sufis are worshippers of God or worshippers of self, whether Sufis claim themselves to be God, whether they are idolaters, or whether they worship the formless God. And the ones who wonder like this have some reason for it, because when they see that in the world there are believers and unbelievers, that there are some who worship God and some who do not, they cannot understand the attitude of the Sufis. They can't decide whether the Sufis are beginners on the spiritual path or whether they have arrived at the goal. If they call them beginners, they cannot prove this to themselves because of the Sufis' personalities, which radiate God. And if they call them the ones who have arrived at the height of spirituality, then they think, how can the Sufis, who are supposed to be God realized, be so childlike as to worship God in the same way as everyone else does, when they say that they do not see any importance in the worship of form, that they are above it? Moreover, there are some attitudes of the Sufis which very much shock the religious, the orthodox, for the realization of the Sufis cannot always be held back. They may try to do so, but sometimes it will leap out, and then one begins to doubt whether the Sufis are really worshipers of God or whether inwardly they feel differently towards God. The Sufis, therefore, are a riddle to those who cannot understand them fully, to those who stand outside of Sufism, for they do not know what the Sufis believe and what they do not believe. That's how he starts this. So he says there are four different stages of God realization for the Sufis. So I'll try to describe them. And it looks like they're serial, you know, that they come in order, but really we're constantly flipping between them. Have you had this teaching before? Okay. Good, okay. So he says the first stage in the teachings on the God ideal, and he's very clear to call it the God ideal rather than God, because the first stage is we have to feel into what is our God ideal. In other words, what does that look like? In one place he says, we have to begin by making a God, you know, by out of our feeling, right? So we know that certain churches or whatever have made a God ideal that looks like an elderly man with a beard, with a stuffed shirt and so on and so forth. But we wanted to feel in to what our ideal is. And in one way, we spent our morning doing that. We called it limitless freedom for the benefit of all sentient beings. So if I were to sit here with you and try to feel into what my God ideal is, a divine, a presence which is always present unconditionally, always with me, closer to me than myself. Unconditionally forgiving. This is, you know, I'm making a process to connect with my conscious feelings about the beloved, if we want to call it that. All powerful, all wise, unconditionally accepting. Go ahead, you help me. What else? Compassionate, omnipresent, omniscient, all-knowing. That's it? Loving. Conditional or unconditional? Unconditionally loving. And generous, you know, pouring forth. Yeah. Accepts boundary currents. Good. A sense of humor. All inclusive. Okay, so this is the conscious part of the first stage of the four stages of God realization on the path to God, using this principle of the God ideal, because we can't call it God. We can say the God ideal because we don't know what it looks like. We can only feel into it. Now, it's important, and he doesn't speak about this in his text, but I do feel it's important for you to recognize and take note that you will and do have an unconscious God ideal. It probably looks something like either your mother or your father. And the negative aspects of your mother or your father. You know, if your father was a pointer, you probably have a pointing God. You know, if your father had a low self-image and corrected you a lot with your faults, then your God is a correcting God. You know, your unconscious God ideal. You following me? Yeah, so it's good to know that, because then... Now, you know, Murshid Sam would rant at us. He would say, Allah is your lover, not your jailer. You know, and he'd rant like that. Allah is your lover, not your jailer. But how many times when we don't like what we're doing, do we feel the, you know, policing eyes of the what we project as the beloved? I'll give you an example for myself. I'm on... it was probably 20, 25 years ago. I'm on a long retreat. Taj Anayat is my retreat guide, my dear friend. And she gives me the assignment to focus on the pictures of my teachers and have darshan. You know that what I mean by that word, darshan, to look into their eyes and feel their, you know, to have a communication through a photograph. Sounds like a good assignment, not bad. But I put up Murshid Sam, and I'm having a good time, and you know, feeling the communication going. And then I put up the picture of an Ayat Khan, and here's what I get: kind of like a stern, you know, kind of stern person. Like, are you doing this right? You know. Now I was. You know, luckily conscious enough to go like, this is likely not how he is. It's something I have to do a little work about because I'm projecting my father onto an ayat. You with me? Yeah, I'm sorry that you are. Yeah. Huh? Yeah, he's very quick. He's a quick study, yeah. So there it was. I had some work to do. Now, you know, like you, and I had to the center of my universe. You know, it's like my lover of lovers. but still that unconscious part of me assigned the judge to people who I felt had power. And I would see that play out in many different aspects of my life. When I could feel relaxed, and when I would feel cautious because there was someone in the room who was father, So that's an example of an unconscious God ideal. Okay, so that's the first stage of the God ideal on the path to God. Now the second stage is a beautiful stage because it has to do with service and surrender. In this second stage, we begin to act and feel that everything that we're doing is for that ideal. Can you connect with that? That generosity, kindness, compassion to relieve suffering, to help sentient beings. It's all to serve the essence of all. To serve limitless freedom, to serve happiness, to serve Buddha nature, to serve God. And when you say the word surrender, you may get confused thinking, well, surrender is weakness. But quite to the contrary, by letting go of the self and surrendering, you become very strong and extraordinarily capable of accomplishing things. So, you're always listening for the voice of God, the voice of guidance, and I beautifully calls it the spirit of guidance, and then we feel from that too that anytime we receive guidance, it's the spirit of guidance in some guise. So whether it's through a child, through a nature, through an animal, through a friend, through a series of events, we feel the guidance stream coming to us and we do our best to cooperate and manifest it. So second stage. Third stage of the path to God, of the God ideal, is a really extraordinarily beautiful stage. Now, everywhere as you look, you see God. When that stage blooms, it's sheer ecstasy. I can think of different halls, experiences that I've had like that. I couldn't move my head 1 degree, I would start to cry. Everywhere, like, But when you say that, then don't be confused that something looks beautiful, like a fruit tree in bloom, or some flower or some being but seeing God everywhere is also seeing it in the deranged person, in the beggar, in the confused person, in the mean person, in the unskillful person, so it's a very, very advanced stage. It's an incredible stage. That's the third stage. Fourth stage, you already know. There's no you anymore. You disappear. Or the thought that you thought you or I merges. There's no more lover and beloved. Rumi says, the beloved is all in all. The lover's only a veil. Our current stage. So, and then through that union, then everything, you can accomplish everything and be an enormous watering fountain for blessing. You know? The beautiful understanding of the path. So let me just stop for a minute and see if there's any questions. Especially, we had a very long discussion this morning. I know people ask me questions during the break. I'm not answering any questions in the break. Got to ask now. That didn't work. Sometimes if you don't ask me questions, I'm going to ask you questions. That sometimes works. I'll tell you my humorous story. My first interview with Murshid Sam. I'm born in 47. It's 1969. So I'm probably 22. I asked Murshid for an interview. He's make an appointment. Now, he lived half the week at the Mentor Garden, and the other half of the week he lived in a home in Novato, California. That means half an hour from the Golden Gate Bridge, you know, so in Marin County, where I live now. I lived in Marin, so the meeting was in Marin. I hitchhiked up there and knocked on the door. And Murshid was very cordial to the traveler. Opened the door. He himself answered the door. How are you? Welcome. So glad to see you. Come into my office. We sit down together in his office. And why did you come to see me? I said, I was very, Wally Ali called me very angelic. Can you believe that? He does. He says, you were so angelic. And I think that's a nice way of saying spacey. I'd sit and watch TV with Murshid, but I'd be sitting there cross-legged, very holy looking, doing mantras while everybody else was engaged in the show. You know, he liked to watch Perry Mason. He loved Perry Mason. But anyway, I'm in there for the interview. Murshid says, and why did you come to see me? And I said, well, Murshid, I don't really have any questions. I just really felt called to come to see you. Without missing a beat, he stood up from his chair and he said, well, thank you very much for coming then. And he walked out. That was the end of the interview. He's gone. Now, I can tell you, you know, having given whatever, you know, 1,000 interviews or whatever number it is, thousands, I don't know the number. 250 of the interviews started with, I don't have any questions. No. No, because you can see the question written there. You know, it's written on someone's face. So okay, how's the kid? You know, 15 minutes later, the question has arrived, nursed out, So that's a different approach. It's a more, what do you call it, Jamali approach. His was very, I call it very brave, because he took a chance, that I would learn the lesson having been deserted, or whatever, cut loose, cut short. Yeah. So. My second interview was at the Mentor Garden. I had just come, I traveled with him for 5 weeks in the East Coast. I didn't have a lot of interviews. I used to go to his house often he said, I need help. And so I'd come to his house and sweep the floor, vacuum the downstairs. And, he had this funny system that if you didn't work, you were supposed to pay $5 a month dues. you know, the whole money thing was confused. Oh, pay, then don't pay, it's free, pay, you know, as it is today, somewhat confused, you know. But if you worked, you didn't have to pay dues. And I kept thinking, like, this is in reverse. If you go work, you're getting all the goodies, you know. You're getting the contact with the teacher, the, you know, the example of how they live, that, you know, it was so rich. Paying $5, you got nothing for that, you know. That's how I felt. But anyway, I'd go to his house a lot. But I'd just come back from traveling with him for 5 weeks in the East Coast. And I had a list of questions. And I wrote them down. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You know. And I sat on the floor in the mentor garden. He sat in a chair. He was wearing a kind of a Italian t-shirt, you know, like white, dirty, scruffy t-shirt, and his khaki pants. And he was in a very altered state, you know, because he kept talking about Jesus. And that was my second interview. Yeah, I had a list. I'd learn how to get in touch with my question. Yeah. Okay, you believed everything I said, that was it. Okay, yes, dear. Just like the poor kids in the womb. Yeah, yeah. Well, we are. Well, that's very optimistic. so many nice things in your question. Thank you. So I'm going to start answering the end of it, and then I'll go to the beginning if I can remember. And so much of our. So much of our concerns today are about sustainability and resilience, you know, developing resilient systems, treating the earth so that it can be its natural resilient self to regenerate because of our unskillful use of the natural resources. And so, and I feel it's very important that we all become contributors, that we do not just our spiritual work, but everything. Be a lover of the earth, be a caretaker of the earth. So in my simple way, I'm a gardener. I've been a gardener all my whole life, my adult life. I caught the bug from Murshid Sam, who was a gardener. Okay, another Murshid story as an interlude. I'm growing my first garden by his example. And I don't know why, but I planted cauliflower. I mean, yeah. For those of you who are gardeners, you know, that's a more advanced degree, you know, cauliflower growing. You know, it's in Marin County, which is a wonderful place to grow food, good climate. I don't really know much, but you know, I followed his example. And my cauliflower has aphids. So I go into the meeting at the Mentor Garden, and you know, I wherever we were, I said, Murshid, my cauliflower has aphids, what should I do? And he says, I'll help you. And then I come in for the next meeting, you know, a few days later. If you've been to the front room in the Mentor Garden, he's sitting up, you know, where I am. It's a small room. I enter the door. He goes, you know, he kind of signals with his hand. I come up. As soon as I'm up there, he says, follow me. Then we go to the kitchen. And he gives me this big bag of asparagus ends. You know how when you make asparagus, he says, boil these and spray your cauliflower, and you won't have any aphids. Okay, well, that was just a good tip for your gardening. But what I want you to see about it was the kind of earthy care that I felt from him as a teacher, not just kind of upper, but, you know, okay, well, you need help with your garden here. Let me give you some tips. Okay. Yeah. So, back to the idea of sustainability, you know, just speaking about myself. So, we put solar panels on our roof. Like it, you live here in Arizona. It's a travesty if you don't have solar panels on your roof. It's stupid. You make money. It'll be a good deal. And now all the solar companies, they'll loan you the money to make money. I'm advertising for their family business. No, I'm overstating the case, but I'm trying to embarrass you. I am. Because let's be part of the solution. Come on. How many of you have solar panels? Nice. So if the other half of you, I know some of you are in rentals, so that's a little more difficult. Well, my own sense is if I were on the city council, I'd say to every house in my district, you put it on or we'll put it on, you know. Yes. Yeah, well, we know in general that most of our views are not the views of the generality, and we just have to be find what's the right way for us to change the system. Sometimes it'll be quietly and sometimes it'll be noisy, and it's, you know, not all of us have your bravery, or we're not all Julia Butterfly. I'm not going to climb up in a redwood tree and live there for 3 years, but I loved it when I met her and thanked her. So, well, we'll each have to find our way, and you know, solar panel, you know, become part of the community solution. It's not that difficult. Nowadays, it's much easier. Yeah. How many of you use Roundup? See that? Nobody. you know, if we're going to give you gardening tips, the best way to get rid of aphids is good soil. There's a gardener's adage, you're better off having a $5 plant with a $50 hole than a $50 plant and a $5 hole. So good soil, good conditions are the way to bug less gardening, you know. But then we live in a world, what I wanted to get to, I didn't want to scold anybody for not having solar, or I did a little bit. Come on, let's do it so we can say, we soupies, we've got solar, you know, 100% solar, you know, or what, huh? So I've had solar for 6 years. It is paid for in full. Now, as long as those panels last, I have free electricity. You know. Yes. Yeah. Okay. I hear you. So we got a better deal going. You know, you'll have to work out the numbers. You know. Oh, I'm losing Shems.
I'll be back.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yes.
I have a garden question.
Oh, garden. Forgot to put that on the poster. Wow. In some ways, that's beyond my... you know, here's an interesting answer. We had a meditation retreat at Lama, and we were meditating at Murshid Sam's Dargah, you know, for a session. We walked up from the dome, for those of you who know the place, up to Sam's grave. And we had a... For some of us, we had an incredibly lovely meditation, but for some people, I don't know why, they were being bitten by flies. You know, there were flies around, but I didn't get bitten, you didn't get bitten either, right? But a couple of people said they kept biting me. You know, we should figure out a different time to be here. And then one woman came up to me, quite kind of, I don't know what the right word is, you know, like, they should get over it, you know. We're supposed to meditate and not, you know, let whatever's happening happen, you know. And so I said to her, I understand what you're saying, and there's validity in it. But in a certain sense, my job is to create favorable conditions. So I said, as an example, if I brought a group here and they were rattlesnakes crawling all over us, you would probably understand that I'd say, let's go to another place, because the conditions aren't that favorable. Though, according to what you're saying now, I should just tell them, get over it, you know? Yeah, so this opportunity in a physical body to realize limitless freedom for the benefit of all sentient beings has a tremendous blessing. There's no doubt that every time we breathe, we're killing organisms. There's no doubt that beyond our scope of understanding, we are supporting universes on every limb. And when I go like this, I've just killed, you know, 500 million. So there's no avoiding it to some degree. And so then you just have to find a middle path. You know, so we can honor your middle path. My middle path's a little different, you know. I like turning the earth over. I see that it supports some beings and it doesn't others. I also look at the food chain, and it's part of the natural process. The bigger creatures eat the smaller creatures. And we just watched a video the other day. I think I had sent it on round on Facebook, how the face of Yellowstone changed by reintroducing wolves. How many of you have seen that video? Remarkable. You haven't seen it? Just Google wolves at Yellowstone. You'll see the video. So wolves had been taken out of the ecosystem some 60, 70 years. Again, the facts can be better understood on the film. So the whole ecosystem changed. When they reintroduced the wolves took care of the overpopulation of deer, and it moved the deer to higher ground, which meant that the plants that normally lived there could come back, and now the riverbeds and the riverbanks became more sturdy, so the flow of water became better. So that supported the beavers, who created dams that brought back the otters and the, you know, it just, the whole ecosystem completely changed. But don't forget that wolves were eating the deer. So in your world, it would have been hard to let those wolves back in. And I honor you for it, but you know that it's a balance. And so it's nice to grow vegetables. I like growing vegetables, and so I support Kent growing vegetables for you. And you can sit inside, do something else. Yeah. But here's what I wanted to get to, because this was all from your question. What's the most sustainable attitude? Because that's what I had to ask myself, is we're working on sustainability, but since our life is a spiritual life, we have to look, what's the essence of sustainability or resiliency? And my answer came, optimism. Gratitude, they're very close. They're very close. And gratitude's an excellent answer too. Anayat says, the optimist takes the chance of losing and the pessimist loses the chance of winning. Now let me, the optimist takes the chance of losing and the pessimist loses the chance of winning. But here you go. Watch your breath. You know, tomorrow we'll do some work with the mysticism of breath, but for now, just watch your inhalation and exhalation and let it be a kind of a natural swing. You know, just feel it. And the inhalation, swing in, and then have a swing out. Okay, and now as a scientist, I'm going to ask you to feel pessimistic, like this is not going to work, and watch what happens to your breath. Okay, this isn't going to work. Look at your breath. Tell me what happened. It basically, you breathe out and you stop breathing. So, let's assume that you had a good reason to be pessimistic. Things were tough. But that when you feel pessimistic, you automatically close the door because you no longer have vitality to even have a chance. It's end of story. Pessimism is an end of a story. Do you follow me? Life, you know, I told this to a group the other day. I said, the equation is, in Icon says, life is equals difficulties. I said to the group, life sucks. Let's have a good time. It does. You get this body. It's got all these things. First, it's gangly, and you don't know how to control it. And then there's a few minutes where it might be okay, and then you get old and decrepit, and you're... skin is no good, and your muscles don't work, your mind starts to, you know. You know, come on, let's have a... yes, yes, go ahead. That's great. Yeah, yeah. Oh, they are. Oh my! I wake up every morning. I intentionally breathe in, say God's name, have a very optimistic attitude in the face of whatever, you know. But let me just finish the example. So go back to the swing of your breath. Come on. Have a nice in breath. Have a nice out breath. Okay, now you have no reason to feel this way, but just, I'm going to be optimistic. Feel optimistic. See what happens. Okay, good enough. What happens? You breathe in. So you can see right away the optimist basically is saying, I'm going to keep opening the door. I'm not going to be the door closer. Life will close doors. You'll die, you'll this, you'll that. You keep being optimistic. And it's the real thing is it's based on good, solid facts because eventually you'll be fully realized Buddha. So that's very hopeful. I'm excited about that. Now, it might take a little while. You know, I don't know, 50 lifetimes, 5 million lifetimes. You know, that's like that story, you know, where the guy says, you know, the drunk says, you know, please go up and ask, Moses is going up, or I don't remember that, how it goes, but, you know, ask God, you know, what's in fate for me? And, you know, Moses, whatever the story is, somebody comes back and says, God says, you know, you've had a pretty funky life, so it's going to take you another 500 lifetimes. And the drunkard says, God knows about me? Only 500 lifetimes? And with the joy of that, he wakes up, you know. You know, just like that. Yeah. So that was the first part of the answer to your question. Be optimistic. It's the most sustainable attitude. No matter what arises, keep breathing. Okay. So I wanted to go back to the other part of your question. What was it? Oh, yes, yes. Okay. Yes, this is something that really takes time. In some ways, to understand your question, we have to go on the understanding the path of forgiveness. And there's a very kind of famous joke line, forgiveness is giving up the hope for a better past. Forgiveness is giving up the hope for a better past. So, in order to go from forgiveness to compassion or kindness, that's what we want to look at in a certain way. Because you're saying, how could I see God in the person who acts so poorly, who's so deranged, who is so mean, and so on? And you're actually saying it about the something outside of you. Far more difficult equation is forgiving our own shortcomings. But it's good to, since that's so hard to get to, we can talk about the outside first. All right? So, in the process of, first thing is to recognize that if we can lay our burdens down, you know, as the song says, our quality of life will improve. Our anger at our father, our mother, our brother, our community, our government, the state of the world, the idiocy of our banking system, the whatever, you know. Wherever you get angry, you know, at the person who abused you and so on, you have to get in touch with that. Because otherwise you won't know what to lay down. And then there's two very powerful ways of making the movement from anger to loving kindness and compassion. And that is a principle I think I mentioned before, which the Tibetans call causes and conditions. That everybody acts, their actions are the results of their causes and conditions. So I've told this story to some of you. For some of you, it'll be a repeat. Some of you haven't heard it. And there was a period, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I was really concentrating on understanding forgiveness. And during that period, this happened. I'm going to Poland to teach. I've been invited to give the Sufi message in Poland. So pretty excited, you know, feeling like, wow. And I'm on my first flight, San Francisco, Chicago, Chicago, Warsaw, Gdansk. That was what I remember. I'm in the best seat of economy on the United Airlines flight, San Francisco to Chicago. I wasn't upgraded. I'm in 8C, the first seat on the aisle. Yeah, if you're a traveler, you know the number of the seat. You know, there's two seats, 8C and AD, and then 9C, D, whatever it is, you know, C, D, E, or whatever the numbers are, J, K, L. And like I said, I'm in a good mood. My habit is to take my laptop with me, have my computer bag, and as soon as the flight takes off, put the bag out so I can put my legs up, take the laptop out. Now I can work. Nobody's going to call me. Nobody's going to ask me questions. And, you know, a lot of time, I love questions. And I love not questions. You know, sometimes I get 15, 20 letters written, substantive letters. Get all this work done before the plane even lands. Yeah, sometimes I watch movies too, so don't get too pure an idea, you know. Sometimes I work, and then if I need to veg out, I'll veg out, you know. But anyway, this time I'm about to work. And just about, the plane takes off, the lady, not directly behind me, but 9D, if CDE, starts yelling at me. Yeah, I don't know who even she is. She says, "Don't put your seat back. My husband's very tall." But she's yelling, you know, kind of, I feel slimed. I don't turn around because my music guru's taught me, if you don't want the monkeys to disturb you, don't look toward them. It's an old adage in India. So I go with that. I don't turn around. I don't pay any mind. I mean, I do pay mind to it, but I don't engage with her. You know, I'm not thinking high thoughts about her. And I'm negotiating like, what do you mean don't put my seat back? I didn't plan the pitch of the seat. That's the airlines. Don't, you know. So I negotiate, and I think I come up with, okay, I'll put my seat back halfway, you know, because it's got the two stages. Put my seat back halfway. She takes her left leg with her shoes on and puts her shoe on my face. Yeah, on my face. This happened. I'm not making this up. Puts it on my face, and now she's yelling at me in a more aggressive manner. If he can't be comfortable, why should you? Again, I don't turn around. I don't engage, but I do, you know, grab her ankle with needed force, not violence, but just with the. I just take it down. So there's no question that it's going down. And I say something like, please don't do that. And I go back to my work of writing letters. Again, I'm not having like super high thoughts about her. I'm feeling like, you know, I'm thinking mostly disdain and, you know, what kind of training did you have to act this? You know, what kind of person are you? How could you act this way? It's not, you know. So, you know, the seatbelt sign goes off. The husband goes to the bathroom's right, you know, it's right here because I'm in the first cabin. He goes to the bathroom. Now, when he comes out, I'm very curious. Like, you know, is the guy an NBA player? You know, is he... And he's very nice looking, very cleanly dressed, a little taller than me, you know, 6'2" something. Not a giant, you know, but I know, I understand. I mean, I'm taller. When I sit in those seats, it's not exactly a super comfort. Anyway, he intentionally stumbles so he can lean in and talk to me. And he leans down and he says, I'm so sorry for my wife's behavior, but I want you to know that two of our family members were just murdered, and we're going back to try to help the family. You know, so I'm very touched. I actually, you know, physically grab his arm so there's affection and sympathy. Right away I say, I'm so sorry to hear about the tragedy in your family. I hope you can be of some help and that you can face your own grief. And we bond. And before he sits down, she goes to the bathroom, the shoe lady. When she comes out, I don't even wait. I just stand up. And now it's me and the shoe lady right there in front of my seat. And I say to her, I'm so sorry to hear about the tragedy. You know, I get to the word the river of grief just pours out. And she and I bond. We don't talk anymore. I didn't hug her because it's a United flight, you know. But, you know, we had the link of sympathy. And she sits down, I sit down. Now, we didn't have any more contact. But now when I'm sitting in my seat, because I understood the causes and conditions of her subhuman behavior or whatever, however you want to frame that, you know, inappropriate behavior, aggressive, inappropriate behavior. Now I felt compassion and loving kindness, knowing that no human being should act this way, but understanding how the causes and conditions got her to that foolishness. So it's clear from that example and from meditating on causes and conditions that every action, skillful, super skillful, medium skillful, mediocre, unskillful, very unskillful, atrociously unskillful, all of them based on causes and conditions. And through that, every single being deserves and needs our compassion, our loving kindness. And in the sense that, as the Tibetans say, that we've had so many lives that at some life, everyone has been our mother and we've been everyone's mother. So now my child is confused by the causes and conditions. Yeah. So a profound understanding of causes and conditions allows you to care for everything and everyone. Yeah. Here's a silly example, then I'll take a question. I go into the bank. You know, any of you, I don't do this anymore because now my assistant does it. But, you know, I'm in a very good mood. I've been working in my office. I'm feeling quite intoxicated. I've got my deposit slip all filled out. You know, I'm very responsible. I'm an important person, you know. And I go into the bank, and the first thing I do is I look at the length of the line. I survey. Now, if the line is long, my mood starts to go down. Okay, so that is already stupid. I've sold my happiness for a stupid line. The line is already long. Why should I give up happiness for it? I've given my happiness away cheap. Okay, then I get on the line. I don't know about you, but the next thing I do is I want to look at the quality of the people on the line because that's going to affect my experience here. Yeah. And I look at the person in front of me and the guy is a mess. He is not prepared. He's fumbling. He doesn't have a pen. He didn't fill out his deposit slip before he got online. I'm an important person. I've been responsible. What is wrong with you? You know, and then I keep my survey going because of my discriminating wisdom. And I get to the tellers. I look at that teller and think like, not very smart. You know, the other teller like, would you do your job and stop chat? You know, so very critical, you know. I'm together. What's wrong with all these people? Okay. Then luckily I've got a little bit of a corrective system. The flag goes off. Wrong answer, you know. You're giving away your happiness too cheap. Or however you want to say it. Okay, so now I make this assumption that my discriminating wisdom was correct. The guy in front of me is a mess. But now I understand he's a mess because of causes and conditions. That I don't know, but it could be his daughter is sick, he lost his job, you know, 100 different things. So now, while I'm standing on line, now I'm making prayers for the guy. I'm just, you know, breathing peaceful breath. I'm supporting him. Let's say I was right about that teller. She's not very bright, you know. She needs my prayers. So now I'm praying for her to get wisdom, and I'm praying for this one to have the skillful means, you know. So now I'm having a great time on the line, and the time is still passing. The same time passes. Actually, I think it's going to be faster because I haven't created turmoil by my attitude for other people's attitudes. So those are, you know, kind of funny examples of how understanding causes and conditions allow us to be of benefit rather than critical. Don't confuse compassion with trust. Don't confuse forgiveness with trust. Don't confuse forgiveness and compassion with condoning someone's behavior. You may have to put the person in jail to protect themselves and others from them, but you can still have compassion. You know, if you've been abused by someone, the idea isn't to say, oh, it was okay, go ahead, abuse me again. Definitely not what I'm saying. You can feel compassion for their unskillful actions, but don't create a situation where they can do it again and put your guard down. So you have to separate your internal process from the external process. Yeah. So those things take time and they happen slowly. You feel it. It makes you cry. You look out and you see the essence of everything eking its way through the most confused situations and the most beautiful situations. Yes. Very good. Okay. Yeah. We want to get in touch with our wounds. An attitude we want to bring into our everyday life. You know, this morning, this afternoon, we went through a bunch of different subjects kind of as they came up. But this morning, we really covered the inner purpose of life. And if we have communicated that, then we've got a really good handle on what the spiritual path is for. But now we have to sort out how to live our life in our current condition. And now this is what's in front of us. Okay, what do we do? How do we move along to transform ourselves and become the rich, beneficial beings we wish to be? And so I think that's what's in front of us and what we should spend the next part of our time on. How do we act? What do we do? And I think you'll find as we have the discussion or the dialogue, is that it's a combination of bringing as much strength and courage, you know, to go to the gym every day and develop yourself. So the process of development, of conscientious working out, as Buddha said, his last advice was, work out thy salvation with diligence. And the other hand, we want to develop the other side of the coin simultaneously, which is to learn how to make friends with life. Not just to know that life is the teacher, but to make friends with it while we work hard to change what we want to change. It's simultaneous, it's paradoxical. We do our best to make change and we relax with what's arising. And so this is what I want to spend the time on after this. So it is 4:10 and let's dedicate. May all beings be well. May all beings be happy. Alhamdulillah. So it's 4:10. We'll see you all back here at 7. If you need
10 minutes to 7,
I want you to know that my teacher Sam Lewis would rant at us. He was not punctual. He was always early, and he would rant and say, "As far as I'm concerned, Allah means being on time.